Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Jennifer Flynn, and I'm working with CPD, Center for Popular Democracy.
And so you have been working on planning for and protesting against the potential, all sorts of potential horrors coming from the Republicans in terms of healthcare policy since the beginning of the Trump administration, right?
Yep, absolutely. As, you know, right after the election, the group of grassroots organizing groups got back together under the umbrella of Healthcare for America Now.
Yeah.
And they reconstituted this amazing coalition that brought together like the DC Beltway policy people, the think tanks, the media savvy groups, the, you know, large email groups with the groups that are comprised of the people who will be most directly impacted by these cuts, you know, low income, people around the country who are organized fighting for jobs, fighting for healthcare, and working on many different issues. And that's actually the coalition that's largely credited for leading the fight that actually won Obamacare.
Let's actually go back to that for a little bit, because I think it's kind of important to remember how that process went down in the first place. So talk about a little bit about the work that you were doing back when, not that many years ago, really, when Obamacare was actually pushed through.
Yeah, so I did not have the privilege of working directly with Healthcare for America Now, although I did work with grassroots organizing groups, and primarily I was working with organizations that were led by people with AIDS who cared very deeply about, you know, passing the Affordable Care Act and, you know, or Obamacare. And certainly we're working alongside HCAN. But, you know, HCAN, Healthcare for America Now, was a coalition that was comprised of mostly old chapters of ACORN, that amazing pioneering grassroots organizing group, and that actually was taken down by, you know, Breitbart Media, Steve Bannon, people who are very much in power now. So, you know, although many of those groups went and reconstituted themselves and their members, you know, just formed another organization. And so some of those organizations are still around today, under, you know, different name, different leadership, and still fighting in under this umbrella organization of Healthcare for America Now.
Right. And so when Trump was elected, I imagine that thinking about healthcare was one of the first things that went through a lot of people's minds, since the Republican Congress had pledged to overturn Obamacare for approximately ever. So tell us about some of the reactions sort of day one after the election, or even before the election, if there was any planning going on then.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, so some people actually believed that Trump might win. So people had already started talking about how vulnerable the Affordable Care Act was. I mean, you know, Congress had voted 60 times to undo it unsuccessfully, or the House had voted 60 times to undo it unsuccessfully. So we, you know, we knew that this was coming. It was something that, you know, he said he would do on day one. We also knew that this was directly, if we could slow down this fight and if we could build a resistance based on this fight, that would only help every other issue that's part of the Trump agenda. So, you know, a lot of other groups that are part of the Center for Popular Democracy Network are also new immigrant groups. And so, you know, we knew that there would be these very targeted attack on immigrant communities. And so, you know, we really saw this as one fight together, that if we could slow down on healthcare, that would actually help every, you know, help immigrants, help stop some of the more horrendous policies. And I still, you know, think that that's true. I mean, I think that we would see, it's hard to believe, but we would actually see policies that were much worse. So a couple of days after the election, a colleague of mine from the AIDS world, we actually worked together in an organization that came out of an effort of bird dogging, of following around mm-hmm. elected officials back in the late 90s. So we worked together in this organization that was really kind of known for bird dogging, particularly during the presidential candidates, you know, when they would go around to Iowa, New Hampshire. And so we had done that work all along. And, you know, so we had been on the campaign trail, like following Trump. And, you know, so we actually could witness firsthand how popular he was in certain parts of the country. Yeah. So my colleague sent out an email just, you know, on two listservs, that these kind of listservs that sprung up the night of the election, where like, yeah. you know, thousands of people joined immediately because yeah. we were all so desperate for something to do in a community to commiserate with. And so he said, you know, I don't really know what to do in this time. My colleague, by the way, is named Paul Davis, and he now works at HousingWorks. Yeah. And he said, I don't really know what to do at this time, but the one thing that I've done in the past that was very effective under previous Republican administrations, particularly under the Bush Jr. administration, is that, you know, we would do this very targeted bird dogging campaign where we would not let any elected official off the hook and just repeatedly ask them questions. And through our question asking, move them, you know, from get a different answer each time, so that we're actually moving them from being, you know, strongly opposed to our view to being closer to our side. And, you know, he said, so if you can get 15 people and a space, I'll come out and do a training. Mm-hmm. And he was actually not working anywhere at the time. And so he just thought a bunch of people in, you know, New York where he lived or where he was close to, he lives in Philadelphia or DC, someplace where he could get to easily would sign up and, you know, he'd go do a couple trainings. Within 3 days, he had 32 cities scheduled. So 15 people went out, you know, someone on the list forwarded it to a bunch of other people, went on a bunch of other lists. They went out and they found 15 friends and they, you know, rented a space or got the space at their library available. And so he was suddenly like inundated with these requests. And so he brought in myself and another of our colleagues, and, you know, went to HousingWorks and said, you know, hey, I think that this is going to turn into something. Can I do this? Yeah. And they actually ended up hiring him. And so the three of us have been going around and, you know, now we've trained to the same principle. We'll train anybody who's got 15 people in a space, and we've trained, you know, over 1,000 people. We're continuing those trainings and, you know, really, and then we've organized people on a listserv to go and do actions and to move electeds through a series of questions. So we, you know, help people draft the questions. We help people think about, well, what if the town hall has like 200 people in it and you really can't get called on, or what if they're not calling on people and they're just using these like teletown halls, or they're just using questions that were written ahead of time. And we brainstorm with all the people that we train on creative ways to kind of hack into those, the new style of non-town halls, as I like to call them. So, but, you know, it actually has, I mean, you know, in the first recess, over 100,000 distinct people, and that's just what we could count, had taken action, direct action with their Congress member. So, you know, really an unprecedented amount of activity. And obviously this is largely because of Indivisible and Move On and Swing Left and Action Together, some of the groups that kind of popped up after mm-hmm. the election, who have really been focusing on bringing this message to their Congress members. And, you know, I think it's just going to continue, and I think it's going to become I think it's actually going to become a better tactic as fewer people go to town halls, because it is one of the few times when you are directly able to ask someone who can turn on or off the lights on your issue, who have the power, you know, their finger on the button to do something about it. And you can actually hold them accountable and have them explain why they're voting the wrong way or they're supporting something. So it's a very important tactic for the Senate recess, which is coming up, and the House is obviously in recess this week. I don't know when this is going to air. So yeah, the House is in recess until May 15th, and then the Senate will be in recess, you know, for Memorial Day. Right. So very important tactic to use as we head into the Senate vote, which we expect to happen in June.
Obviously, for various reasons, people have sort of said that this bill faces higher obstacles in the Senate. What are some easy sort of lessons that people can take from the successes that people have had so far in these town halls, the successful halting of the bill the first time around? What kinds of things have you learned just since this process has begun?
So I think that something that's important to remember is that, you know, this is going to be relentless. So beating it back, slowing it down in the Senate, this go around, which I think we're absolutely capable of doing, doesn't mean like we get through this recess and then it's over, we've won. They're going to keep trying to do this at every turn. And so we actually have to think about ways that this can build our movement. We can't just bring over, you know, and the administration, as we saw with the House, will use every single tool that they have in their toolbox to pressure the senators and, you know, to pressure the House when they have to vote again to vote the way that they want, to vote for the terrible AHCA in whatever form.
Right.
And, you know, and by the way, we believe that, yeah, we can win some things on the Senate side. So, you know, we think that we can probably do away with the Medicaid block grant, but we don't think that we'll be able to do away with the Medicaid per capita caps, which is a structural reform to Medicaid and does actually shift it from being an entitlement to being something that a state chooses. So that actually is devastating to the Medicaid program. I mean, we rely, you know, we think of it as this thing that's there for us when we reach the age or, you know, God forbid something happens to us that we get sick and we need Medicaid, right? And it should no longer be taken for granted if that passes, that it will be there for us. And in many states, it won't be there. And, you know, you even hear a Congress member saying, we'll just move to another state. We'll be able to win back some. Right now, the House covers 1% of pre-existing conditions. Some of them are very funny, like a C-section's not covered, but a vasectomy is, you know, so like that's not a pre-existing condition where you won't get health insurance. So, but we think that we can win back some of those, but, you know, we'll have 10% maybe at most of pre-existing conditions covered. It will still be a loss of health care at this point, we think it will still be 24 million because the House bill as it stands, we'll know from the CBO score, which should come out sometime next week, you know, just how many Americans would lose health insurance under the plan that passed the House, which is probably more than 24 million. But it'll still, you know, be devastating to most people in the country, to many people in the country. And so, you know, I think that a thing to learn is just that we have to be relentless and we have to actually really move senators over to our side. It can't just be something that's temporary. And they have to feel that we're going to remember this when we go to elect the new House in 2018, and that we're going to remember it beyond that, because remember, senators are little states, you know, they've got a couple years in office. So we need to prove to them that we've got a long memory and that this will impact their jobs. So when Trump says, I'll take, you know, as he did to Representative Frelinghuysen in New Jersey, he said, I'll take away your chairmanship of Ways and Means, that's, you know, and obviously that means a loss of money for him. It means a loss of a nice office for him, a loss of, you know, a lot of staff for him, a loss of prestige, a loss of power. We need to be able to say, you know, forget about your chairmanship. We're going to take away your whole job.
Right.
And somehow we have to send the message that that's true. We have to start thinking that way and we have to start, you know, really organizing ourselves that way. So I think that the 2018 election is actually incredibly crucial to prove that this will have an impact.
Yeah. Are there, in the Senate in particular, are there any targets that, particularly I'm thinking about Republicans who are up for re-election in the next election cycle, who might be vulnerable to pressure because they might actually lose an election?
Yeah, I mean, there's senators who are also vulnerable because they, you know, they're somewhat on the fence or they're, So there's, you know, Susan Collins, who sometimes votes differently or thinks differently. There's Murkowski, there's Heller, Capito, Flake, Cassidy, Portman. And then there's some, you know, senators who are just sort of surprising and do different things, like Cotton and Boozman have been saying things about, they have some serious questions about the bill as it was passed. And you know, our job is to try to make it so that whatever compromise is created still has all of the deficits of the bill that was passed in the House. You know, we can't, or shine the light on all the deficits, because it will have all of the deficits. It just may cover them up a little bit. So, and, you know, I have something to say that so Indivisible wrote this amazing guide, and they've created an amazing infrastructure. And they put this one thing in the guide, and I've gone around and I've trained a lot of people who kind of get their direction from the Indivisible guide. Yeah. And so they put this one thing in where they said, by all means, always be from the district, you know, because otherwise you'll be criticized as being your bust-in.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that, like, and so that, I think, slowed us down a lot. People were very reluctant to drive 10 miles to another person's district and question and, you know, go to the office of that Congress member. And, you know, there was thousands of people like in South Orange, New Jersey, who wanted to go to Frelinghuysen's office, but he's, you know, 2 miles away and so in a different district. And, you know, it took a while for people to recognize, you know, Congress, just like in regular society, there are some Congress members who are more powerful than others.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are some who make, like, you know, Representative MacArthur represents 700,000 people, and his actions took away health care for 24 million people around the country.
Right.
It is absolutely fine to go to another district. It is absolutely fine to go and meet with someone who has the, you know, who has the ability to make a life and death decision for you.
Yeah.
And explain why you disagree with them. And so I just really encourage us all in this. I mean, obviously it's easier for the Senate because,
yeah,
our senators, you know, represent the whole state. But, you know, in New York, we know Schumer is going to be, you know, not going to cave, hopefully, you know, we know.
Hopefully.
But we can go, right? I know. But we can go to, you know, New Jersey, their senators will be good. We can go to Ohio. We can pressure Portman. We can go to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that will have any impact on Toomey. But we can travel and we can talk to other members. And we can say, we can go to Maine. We can go to Maine and, you know, spend a week there and talk to Collins about why she should stand strong.
So I wanted to ask a couple of questions about sort of bird dogging. I mean, as we've seen, Congress members are less likely now to hold any sort of public town hall, but their schedules are often public, or at least parts of their schedules are often public. As we saw this week in New York, when everybody showed up to see Paul Ryan outside of Harlem Success Academy. And so do you have any advice for people who, say, find out where their congressperson is going to be? And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so so we had, you know, in this organization that I used to work for, which I'll give a shout out to, Health Gap, which came out of a bird dogging effort. We saw every opportunity as a bird dogging effort. Like, town halls are just one small part of it. And the best ones are actually fundraisers. And those are actually fairly easy to find out about. You know, you can, especially if you live in a district, the person at the hardware store might say, I'm having a house party for so-and-so. And, you know, remember, it's terrible that people run for office near, you know, almost the day after they are elected into office. But it's also great for bird dogging because it means that they're almost constantly fundraising. So, you know, if you find out in the local paper that there's a fundraiser, go to it. And, you know, and what we always tell people is, I have this funny story of some students went to a fundraiser, and you know, it was one of these like house parties where people are standing around, you know, with wine and there's some cheese, and
right,
you know, the candidate comes in or the elected official comes in and gives a speech. And then there's really no question because, like, it sort of feels like everybody knows everybody.
Right.
And, you know, like, he'll just come around and shake hands and say thank you and leave. And so, you know, they went and he's giving a stump speech. And then one of the students just raised her hand. And, you know, and he said, oh, I'm not going to take questions. I'll come around and, you know, talk to each one of you individually because I really want to get to know you because, you know, everyone in the room is supposed to be a donor.
Right.
And then she just stood there and kept her hand raised. And then her friends just raised their hands. So there's three people who know no one at this house party. And, you know, the host comes over and says, I'm sorry, honey, he's not taking questions. Put your hands down. And they just stared straight at him and kept their hands raised. And, you know, like a murmur is going through the room. And, you know, finally he feels uncomfortable and these are donors. So he says, I guess I'll take some questions. So, like, do not allow, you know, it is not impolite to ask a question. I did hear that a reporter got arrested for asking a question too loudly of Price. But up until then, I've never heard of anyone getting arrested for asking a question. You know, it's the cornerstone of democracy. I mean, they're elected officials. You have every right, or they're trying to get into office. You have every right to ask some questions, and those questions can be strident. I mean, you know, you can ask them why they took away healthcare for 24 million people. You can ask them how they expect to vote on Medicaid. Do they intend to preserve it as an entitlement? And, you know, and I think do it at every juncture. Obviously, it's harder when there's these kind of protests, although they also serve a purpose. You know, there's so many people coming, you can't necessarily get in a question. But one thing that they did yesterday at the Paul Ryan event was, you know, they had the almost 1,000 people outside. I thought it was almost 1,000, almost 1,000 people outside. And then they had a smaller group that stood by the doors, ready to like shake hands and ask a question. And that's a really smart way to get direct questions to elected officials in this moment. Doesn't always mean that's successful, but you know, I think it's okay because I think that the media that was generated yesterday at the Paul Ryan Success Academy protest really sent him a message that people were unhappy about the healthcare bill and frankly about his support of charter schools. But
Yeah. Any more advice for people who want to be doing this, who are?
Yeah. So in our training, there's two things that we prioritize. One, question writing. We encourage people who can to write it down. One, because the process of writing it down helps, you know, embed it into your memory. And two, because it's always nerve-wracking. Like, I'd rather talk to 500 people in, you know, in a room in front of 500 people than to talk to, like, one elected official in a suit who can kind of, maybe seems like he can outsmart me. And, you know, the other thing is we encourage people don't ask questions on the technical details. Like, you don't need to know what per capita caps are or what health savings accounts are, or you don't need to explain that. Just, you know, ask the basic question, will your plan increase the number of people who will have access to health insurance? Will your plan, you know, keep Medicaid as an entitlement? All of those things are fine to ask in the most basic sense, right? Yeah. Tell a personal story. The other very magical thing is to raise your hand if they do take questions first, fast and high. And it is, there's something in the human DNA where we have to call on people when they raise their hand first. It's not jumping out of your seat because that scares people. It's just putting your hand up very confidently. And it's actually really, really, really hard to do because you're all prepared, you're nervous, you got in, you sat down, you wrote your question down, you met with a team, you're sitting in different locations. So, you know, they can't say like the right side of the room or all the crazy left wingers or whatever, you know, like you're sitting in different places, you raise, and you just want like another 30 seconds to get it together. So you don't want to raise your hand first, but that's the key to getting a question is to just raise your hand and then take the, you know, the 5 second breath before you ask it.
Any last thoughts for what people can do or also of where they can connect up with groups that are doing this work around healthcare?
Yeah, sure. So if anybody wants to be trained in bird dogging and get connected to a national effort to go out and bird dog their candidates, they certainly can contact me or Paul Davis or Jaron Benjamin, who are at HousingWorks. So my email is jflynn@populardemocracy.org. And if you got 15 people in a space, we'll come out. Of course, you can get lots of information at Town Hall Project about where there's events. If your elected doesn't do a town hall, then make one yourself. You know, get the library community room and invite a bunch, make a flyer, make a Facebook event, and invite a bunch of people, send a letter to your elected saying that you're going to hold a town hall, and, you know, they better show up. Now you can actually get the closest, more progressive Congress member to do the adopted district, and they might hold the town hall in lieu of the, you know, Congress member who won't, which is a great way to get media attention. You can have a suit, an empty suit, or a picture of the Congress member who won't show up. And then you just hold the town hall, like ask the questions just as you want, and just let the silence sit there with their non-response, which is a really powerful thing. And then, of course, you know, Facebook Live it, put it up on the internet. And there's, you know, Indivisible sends out an email every week with updates. And, you know, of course, get connected to Move On and Resistance Near Me. And the great thing is that now the hardest thing used to be finding the places where the electeds were. Now the hardest thing is to just show up. And so I would just say that I think that it will help build the movement and get us to the summer if we can really delay the vote in the Senate in June. So if you felt like you were getting burned out, but you have it in you to continue doing a high level of action, please do so to delay the healthcare bill past June. You know, they'll break for the summer, so we'll buy ourselves some time. And then there's actually some technical things that kind of reset the process a little bit. So, you know, we've even bought ourselves some more time if we can just get through the summer. So, you know, now's the time. Now's not the time to slow down. Now is the time to ramp it up. And that's not to say that's not going to be a marathon. It is definitely going to be a marathon. But this is a key time to try to save healthcare for 24 million people.
Excellent. And other than emailing you, can people keep up with you on social media as well?
Oh, yeah, sure. So on Twitter, I'm Jennifer Flynn, and my Facebook is Jennifer Flynn Walker.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.